like Skylar said, neither of us are qualified pastors and meant to be running this event, but here we are. And Skylar's done much more research than I have, so I have the privilege of interviewing Skylar about the question this evening: was Jesus the Messiah? And did he meet the expectations specifically for the Messiah? So to kick us off, I think the logical place to start is, what's a Messiah? So Skylar, what is even the Messiah? What does Messiah mean?
It's a great question, and one that we definitely should start with. First of all, if you do have a Bible, I will be listing a bunch of different books and chapters and verses and things. And I brought some of my own Bibles. If you want a physical one, or you don't have one on your phone, and you still want to follow along, you can see my lineage of very kind of cheap Bible to my boys' Bible to my different other Bibles. Bible sits by my bed.
What a joy! What a joy!
But anyway, so a Messiah.
Yes. What is it?
So obviously Christianity comes from Judaism, and Jews spoke Hebrew. So the Old Testament's written in Hebrew, and Messiah in Hebrew is means anointed one or chosen one. And similarly, when you hear Christ, you hear Jesus Christ, it's not saying, you know, that's not his last name that we've given him, but it's a kind of Greek transliteration of that word Messiah. So that's what Christ means. So it's that kind of anointed one, someone who's anointed.
Christos, isn't it, in Greek?
Yeah. At the very beginning of the Bible, we start to see this kind of Messiah figure. So in Genesis, which is the first book of the Bible, we have the creation of the world. Everything is good. God creates humans. It's very good. But then we get to Genesis chapter 3, and we have the fall, which we like to call it. And after the fall comes these verses in chapter 3, from God, saying, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go," so speaking to the serpent, "and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So right there we have this kind of faint image of someone that's going to be born of a woman, and is going to strike this serpent's head. And we understand the serpent to be the figure of evil, or the Satan. And we see that the serpent will get crushed, but this man from the woman is going to have a bruised heel from the serpent. So that's the very beginning. And then we again see this messianic promise when we get to Abraham. So years later, and then we get to Abraham, which is the kind of father of the Abrahamic faiths, so of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And God promises that he will make multiple nations of Abraham, and that this is going to be done through his descendants. So we see a descendant from Abraham in Genesis 22. Continuing through the Abrahamic lineage, we get Abraham's son, Isaac. So it's not going to be through Abraham's other son, Ishmael. It's going to be through Isaac that this Messiah promise is going to come through. After Isaac, then we come to Jacob in Genesis 28. So Esau giving up his bowl of soup, and Jacob taking his inheritance, and therefore he gets the Messianic lineage. And then we have the sons of Jacob, so the 12 sons, you know, of Joseph. And interestingly, it's not the first son or Joseph, you know, that might get this descendant, but we hear that it's from Judah in the end of Genesis that this messianic promise comes from. And we also, when we go, so after the sons of Jacob, we go into this time of Exodus, in Egypt and leaving Egypt, and there's this guy called Moses that is there to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, and we see in Deuteronomy chapter 18 that there's going to be this prophet that's like Moses, that's even greater than Moses, that is going to lead God's people. So we have this start to see, we don't have much detail of who this Messiah will be, but we start to see of God's kind of promise and faithfulness that there will kind of be this. And I do want to say that this is kind of, when we think of Messiah, we have to include, Judaism and the Jews. And interestingly, some do believe in a Messiah, but there are still some Jews that don't. They would believe in some sort of kind of universal messianic age, but not through a specific person, which is interesting.
Yeah, because you have Jewish people today who would call themselves messianic Jews, who are, for all intents and purposes, Christians, because they recognize Jesus as the Messiah. But then you've also got within Judaism today, it's split into Reformed and Orthodox. So you have Messianic Jews, who are Jews who have accepted Christ as the Messiah. You have Orthodox Jews, who really traditionally hold to the Torah and the Jewish Old Testament. Then you have Reformed Jews, who are much more modern and liberal, aren't they, and progressive.
Yeah, so continuing on this kind of idea of it's going to be like a person Messiah that's going to do this. We start to learn that he's going to come from a very specific lineage from King David, who we read about in 2 Samuel. And we hear that he's going to be from David's throne in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12, which I'll read right now, which says, "When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers," so when David passes, "I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took from Saul, whom I put away from before you." So before David was this King Saul, but God's not chosen to provide the Messiah through the lineage of Saul, but through the Messiah through his good King David. This is where we start to see more kind of prophetic kind of writings. We've been reading so far in kind of historical books, law books, but then when you get to a guy called Isaiah, who is a prophet of God, we start to see more kind of description of a Messiah. And if you've ever been to like a carol service or something, this is probably where you'll probably hear these different things. So Isaiah chapter 9 is a very famous one. Starts, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light," and then talking about, "For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given. Government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it." And we also have this picture, again, in Isaiah 49. I won't read it. That it's not just for the Jews, but it's also for the Gentiles, for those that aren't from the Jewish heritage, but us, and all over the world, that will be included in this. And then, interestingly, we start to see in Isaiah 53, this Messiah, or this servant, how Isaiah describes it, the suffering servant for God. The servant that is suffering. And many Christians will believe this to understand that this is speaking of the Messiah and speaking of Jesus. And it's a little bit of that callback to the serpent, that does bite the heel of the Messiah, of the Savior, and there is some suffering that will happen. And then in Daniel, which is another prophet, another major prophet, we see that this is where we see the name Son of Man, where if you've ever read the Gospels, is the name that Jesus tends to give himself most of the time. And we see that the Son of Man is going to reign eternally over the kingdom of God. So this is this kind of wide picture of who the Messiah will be.
Yeah, a lot of information there. And I'm sure we'll get into just a second a bit more about what Jesus said about himself, I think, as well. But just to, as a bit of a recap, what is the Messiah? Well, we've got this idea of the Anointed One, God's chosen one, which we see from the beginning of the biblical story. Even in Genesis, we have echoes of it. And we have echoes of it all throughout the Old Testament in people like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, up until David, who's a really important one, as a king. So we have this anointed Messiah, this anointed one who is going to be king. And also these prophecies, which are talking about how he'll suffer as well, and bring redemption to the world. And so he's a king, he's a suffering servant, and he's going to bring redemption to everything for all time, forever. And that's, I think, that's a really important thing as well, that it's not just someone who's going to come and is going to bring peace as he's king in that particular time, but there's an emphasis on forever. It's an anointed king, a suffering servant who will bring peace and redemption forever. So we've got a bit of an idea of what the Messiah is, what it means, a bit of a biblical history lesson for everyone, myself included. But what prophecies or what parts of the Old Testament would you say in particular point to Jesus most specifically? Which ones are most unique?
Yeah, that's great, because you know, it's good to talk about, you know, lineage and things. And if you look in Matthew chapter 1, you can see that Matthew does write out that lineage to show that Jesus does come from this Davidic line. But there are interesting things, prophecies about the Messiah that are very unique to Jesus. One of them is in Isaiah chapter 7. So again, talking about prophecy, where Isaiah speaks of, in verse 14, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us. So here's an interesting one of this Messiah figure is going to be born of a virgin, which is very unique.
What?
Doesn't normally happen. And we do see in the Gospels that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary. In Micah chapter 5, if I can go to it quite quick, Micah 5 verse 2 says, "But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, you are too little to be among the clans of Judah. From you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient of days." So here in Micah, who's another prophet before Jesus' time, you know, at least 400 years. So Isaiah is even 700 years. So that's probably a good thing to say, that all these prophecies are way before Jesus' time.
Long before his time.
And here we see that supposedly this Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem. And again, we know from the Gospels that Jesus of Nazareth was born in Bethlehem.
Yeah, and those two, I think, are great, and because they are really specific, but they're also things that Jesus could have had no control over as well. And we'll get into some reasons why people might think that he wasn't the Jewish Messiah, but one of them, for the prophecies that he fulfilled during his lifetime, you could argue, well, you know, he knew the prophecies, he knew the Old Testament really well, and he was just purposely fulfilling them. But these were two that he couldn't have possibly fulfilled intentionally, because they were before he was even born.
Yeah, excellent. So I mentioned before Isaiah 53 of the suffering servant. So if we do kind of connect this with Jesus, we can really see the connection with Jesus on the cross, his crucifixion. You can read it for yourself, but there's different, you know, particular points that really point to it. So 53 verse 7 says, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth." And Mark even tells us that Jesus did not speak when I think it was Pilate what was questioning him in front of the public. So that's, I have Mark 15 verses 4 to 5. Isaiah 53 verse 9 says that, "And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death." And this can allude to Jesus being hung with criminals on the cross, and the rich man in his death, Joseph of Arimathea, again, really kind of connecting this to Jesus. As well as the idea of suffering and saving for the sins of the world, I think is a great connection to Jesus. In the Psalms, many written by David, but also other people. I won't read them all, but Psalm 78 speaks of someone that's going to speak in parables, We see Jesus doing that. Even Matthew 13, verses 34 to 35, Matthew specifically writes that Jesus spoke in parables to fulfill the prophetic promises in the Old Testament. In Psalm 22, which is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is what Jesus cries out to when he's on the cross. And there's just so many things in there at that point to Jesus. So first of all, his cry out to God, my God, my God, that he uses. But verses 7 to 8, we see them mocking. So all who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. So they're saying to Jesus on the cross, if you're the Son of God, you know, then come down. Let God rescue you. There's verse 15, my strength is dried up like potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. So we hear in the Gospels that Jesus was thirsty. He asked for a drink. In verse 16, for dogs encompass me, a company of evildoers encircles me. They have pierced my hands and feet. Again, alluding to Jesus' hands and his feet nailed to the cross. And what's so interesting is that crucifixion, was a Roman implement, and at this time wasn't even a thing when the psalm was written. Verse 17 and 18, continuing right down, I can count on my bones. Jesus is, and they stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Very famously in Luke talks about the guards casting lots for Jesus' clothing. We see in Psalm 16, I won't read it, but we see this kind of illusion that God's Holy One is going to be resurrected. Again, another thing that only Jesus did that really points to him. I also found interesting, it's not as clear, but in Matthew 27, verses 7 to 8, I'll read if I can find it. It's a good thing I have all these labels. You'd think, you know, if I was going to do this, I would have everything, you know, out. But what I say, Matthew 27, 7 to 8. And this is speaking of the 30 pieces of silver. And it says, so they took counsel and bought with them the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, saying, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price for him on whom a price had been set by some of the sons of Israel. And you can see in both Jeremiah, chapter 19, if you want to look, and Zechariah, this idea of selling a field that's going to be, I forget the word that's written, but you know, it's similar to a field of blood, as well as 30 pieces of silver, which would have been the price for a slave, alluded to in Zechariah, I believe is the one I said, chapter 11, which again is interesting. And then one that I might have heard before, but I didn't really remember, is the timing of when Jesus would arrive was prophesied. And you can see that in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 26. I should say I'm jumping around quite quick. So if you've never held a Bible, I'm very sorry that I can't do Bible training for you on where all the books of the Bible are.
Another week.
So Daniel chapter 9. So if you go to the middle of the book, you find Psalms, and then about seven books later or so, you're going to find Daniel, maybe eight. So Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 26. So 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal vision and profit, and to anoint a most holy place. Know therefore and understand that from going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. Now, I won't go into the exact kind of explanation of that those verses, but essentially kind of knowing when kind of the kings around that time were, Artaxerxes and such, it puts Jesus's crucifixion right up to basically when it happened in AD 33, AD 30. And so I do encourage you, you know, don't take my word from it, you know, look up Timing of the Messiah, Daniel chapter 9. And I think that's, again, also a really interesting thing.
Yeah, really, really interesting. All stuff that was prophesied so many hundreds of years before Jesus arrived and then is fulfilled in this one person who we read about in the Gospels. And it is interesting, like you're saying, reading the Gospels, because most of the Gospel writers are quite aware that Jesus is doing these things when they're writing. And a lot of the Gospels are written so that you would believe that Jesus is Christ, the Messiah. And like you're saying in Matthew, like, Jesus did this, which fulfilled this, and Jesus did this, which fulfilled this. Almost as you're reading the Gospels, they're telling you, like, look, he's fulfilling these. He's the one. We're telling you. That's the whole point. I wonder if it'd be worth looking at what Jesus said about himself. Obviously, we've seen that he's fulfilled these prophecies that were quite specific, and the gospel writers clearly thought that he was doing this. That's why they wrote about him. Mm-hmm. That's why we're here today. But what did he say? Did he say anything specifically himself about being the Messiah?
Well, yeah, I think that's really interesting, and because we do see in the Gospels, particularly remember a moment in Mark where. Where Jesus, you know, but who do you say I am? And I can't remember the exact words, but it's, you know, like you're the Messiah. Where I think it's Peter finally recognizes it. But Jesus, you know, doesn't say, you know, go all out and tell everyone. You know, he says hush. And I think that's because that at that time. Messiah would have been a very scary term for the Romans. They would have kind of knew that the Jews were expecting, you know, a savior, someone that was going to, you know, kick out the Romans, you know, rule with an iron fist. And hearing that a Messiah, you know, was here, the Romans would have been very hot on Jesus's tail,
yeah,
I think.
Pretty scared.
So Jesus does recognize that... Or alludes to that he is the Messiah. And again, he uses that title, Son of Man, and Daniel, for himself, which again alludes to that he sees himself as the Messiah.
Yeah, definitely. And you're so right. It's called the Messianic Secret, isn't it? They talk about, especially when reading Mark, you're reading it and like, why Jesus is telling everyone, shh, don't tell anyone. I'm fulfilling these prophecies and doing these miracles, but don't tell. And you're like, Jesus, why are you saying that? But you're exactly right, because if he'd gone around trumpeting, oh, like, I am the Messiah, then the Romans would have been like cracked down, and it allowed him to do the ministry that he needed to do and what he wanted to do. A favorite passage of mine, I love John chapter 4 just in general, and the woman at the well. But there's a part, verse 25 of John chapter 4, the woman at the well says, like, I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. And when he comes, he'll explain everything to us, showing that the people at the time were expecting it, they were waiting for it. And Jesus just says, that, well, then Jesus declared, verse 26, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. I am the Messiah. Which, yeah, like I've been saying, he knew that he was the Messiah. He was very conscious of that. And I think it's quite an important point as well, because I know especially a lot of Muslims who are trying to challenge the Christian faith will come up to you and say, well, where does, you know, Jesus never said he was the Messiah. Jesus never said he was the Son of God. Jesus never said this. And it's important to be equipped that actually Jesus did know who he was, and he did say things that you can't deny, that he knew that he was the Messiah and said those things clearly. But whilst we're talking about reasons not to think he was the Messiah, what are some of the most popular arguments against Jesus fulfilling the expectations for a Messiah?
So I guess the first one that comes to mind is, could this have happened all by accident? You know, was this just some random chance? And I found it really interesting. Read it in the book that I recommend, which is The Case for Christ, which was also recommended last week. So if you just think of eight prophecies of Jesus, having eight prophecies of the Messiah, could someone fulfill those on, you know, by chance, by random? And it's one in 100 million billion, which is 1 × 10⁻¹⁷, which is millions of times greater than the amount of people that have ever walked this earth. And here's a picture for you. The book says, imagine covering the state of Texas. Now, I know not Americans, but U.S. or the U.K. is about 2.8 times, or Texas is 2.8 times the size of the U.K. So if you cover it in, like, coins, he says silver dollars, that the silver dollars would cover around 2 feet. And you imagine putting a man there, blindfolding him, and then expect him to find the coin that would reach that all those prophecies.
Yeah, it's ridiculously small, isn't it? And that's just eight. That's just eight prophecies.
That's just eight prophecies.
Wow.
Which is so it's very hard to argue that this was just a coincidence that Jesus of Nazareth fulfilled these prophecies. And interestingly, if you think of 48 prophecies, you know, it's a crazy number. It's trillion, 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 billion universes, the atoms in those universes. That's the probability, which I can't even think of.
Small. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let alone the atoms in this universe, that many universes.
I want to know more about the maths.
Apparently someone sat down and like, if a person was born here and here, right. But you know, born of a virgin is
a big one.
Big one, but you know, the other easy ones of the lineage. You know, someone born in Bethlehem. You know, might have died on a cross. I don't know. Then, you know, maybe, but it's really hard to argue.
Yeah, it'd be interesting maths, wouldn't it? But like, well, this guy, he was born this time. There were this many other people born like that year. So I don't know. I don't know what the maths were. Yeah, it'd be interesting to look at.
Absolutely crazy. the other, which we see argued all the time about Christian teaching is, were the Gospels altered? You know, did the writers alter things so that it made Jesus look like the Messiah? I've spoke on this before. Others in this church have spoke on this. And I believe we can argue as Christians that you can trust the Bible, that you can trust the Gospels, that there were eyewitnesses, and if anything that the writers said was wrong, then people would be very quickly to point them out, especially the Jewish community. That didn't recognize Jesus as the Messiah would easily have pointed out any falsehoods that the gospel writers wrote, as well as seeing the disciples, how their lives are changed, and that they go on to death proclaiming Jesus as the Messiah, claiming him as Christ, the Son of God, doing all that. Imagine doing that and knowing that you falsified the facts. Is a very hard argument to make.
Yeah, people don't die for what they know not to be true. I think is the simple way, yeah, to put that.
Another one, very quick. Could Jesus maneuver his life to do these prophecies? You mentioned before, you know, one of them, where born in Bethlehem. How could Jesus maneuver that? You know, how could I choose where I was born? How could you choose where you were born? How could he choose that he was supposedly born of a virgin? How could he have chosen to be born at such a time that was prophesied in Daniel? Again, you know, maybe he could maneuver some of them, but definitely, you know, not all of them that he has. And lastly, you know, do Christians take these verses out of context, these prophetic verses out of context? And I won't go into detail, obviously. It takes some deep reading. But, you know, if that is an argument that you hold, then I challenge you to look into that and see for yourself. And time after time again, when people have come with that challenge and have researched it, they've come to see that, you know, it speaks for itself.
Yeah, great. I've got a final question, I think, before we, not pre-planned, just before we open it up to group discussion and then questions and answers afterwards. But I think one of the most striking things that I notice when we're asking this question, did Jesus meet the expectations for the Messiah, is that there are still Jews. obviously, there are some Messianic Jews who recognize that Jesus fulfilled these prophecies and is the chosen Messiah, but there are hundreds of thousands, millions of Jewish people still today, whether Orthodox or Reformed, who clearly don't recognize Jesus as a Messiah. So what do you think are some reasons that they have for not recognizing Jesus as a Messiah? Or do you have anything to...
No, that's really interesting because the book, Case for Christ, which is written by Lee Strobel, who was an atheist journalist, and he investigated the specific evidence for Jesus. And this chapter that I took a lot of my thinking from, he has an interview with a former Jew who grew up with he grew up in a Jewish circle where there wasn't that much kind of thinking, you know, into a Messiah, and especially not Jesus as Messiah. And obviously, so you think you go to synagogue, you hear the teachings, you know, from the rabbis. Obviously, they're not going to teach from you know Jesus. And you yourself, you don't, you know, research for yourself and investigate it. But what's really interesting for him, which is maybe not for your question, but for him as a Jew, when he went through his own Jewish Bible, so not you know the Christian Bible, you know, with the New Testament. And he's like, oh, maybe they changed the verses that, you know, they pulled out and things. And he looked at his Jewish Bible, and he looks at, you know, Isaiah, Daniel, other prophets. And his only conclusion was that this is Jesus, which is amazing. But so specifically, I think, you know, it's the way that they're brought up and taught. As I said, some Jews believe that it's not through a person. So they're still waiting for that kind of messianic age, and obviously we're not in that age where you know we have war after war, and so you know they also believe in a world that's unified with peace and love, but not through a person. And then similarly, for whatever reason, and maybe because you asked this question, you know something or two. But there are Jews that are still waiting for a specific person, and maybe it's because it's less about it's more for the Gentile, you know, all the Gentiles instead of specifically for the Jews, because the Jews do believe that the tribes will be reunited in Jerusalem, rule from Jerusalem and Israel.
Yeah, really good. A couple of thoughts off the back of that. One, I think you're absolutely right that dynamic between Jews and Gentiles is really important. And I don't think we touched on it specifically, but part of the Messianic prophecies are that this is a Messiah, a suffering servant who's going to be rejected by his own people. And so that's an interesting part in the fact that a lot of Jews today don't recognize him is actually fulfilling a Jewish prophecy about the Messiah is an interesting point. But also, I think you mentioned peace and the Messiah bringing peace to the world. Can we dig into that?
Yeah.
Just because we believe that the Messiah has come.
Yes.
Jesus has come.
Yes.
And is the anointed one, the king, who will bring peace and redemption to the world. But there's war.
Yes.
And there's not peace. How do we marry those two things?
Well, so the Jews, there's not so much. They're not really, there's not a second coming. They're expecting the Messiah to come to rule over all the nations, to everyone comes together under him, Whereas as Christians, we believe that there is still a time on this earth, this kind of in-between stage, where we're not in this, you know, yeah, we never say, I think as Christians, you know, this messianic age is very kind of Jewish saying, but there will be a time when there is a new heaven and a new earth, where we as Christians believe that we will see that peace amongst. But that's only, you know, it's available for those that understand and choose Jesus, the Messiah, to be their savior.
Yeah, amen. Yeah. And we're waiting and hoping for that second coming and praying.
And it's
for
a
that.
Certain hope.
Yeah, it is a certain hope. Absolutely. And that's, I mean, we don't have enough time to talk all night. But I personally find that a really fascinating aspect of prophecy is that now and not yet. And the idea that a prophecy, I think N.T. Wright is really good if you're interested in prophecy in general, the way he talks about it. But saying that we are so used to reading things really black and white. This is either true or it's not true, or this is, you know, a very scientific way of approaching text. But prophecy in particular, we should just be reading so much more holistically. And the idea that this prophecy can be fulfilled, it can be fulfilled and also still need to be fulfilled. So we have that but partial fulfillment, but it's also still what we're looking forward to as well. So we need to, in some sense, step back a bit and have a bit of more of a complete understanding of what prophecy actually is.